Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. First Nation citizens on some reserves or settlements now have more options to purchase or renovate homes. There's changes to the way the federal government is handling First Nation-specific claims, and that's not sitting well with First Nation leadership. The National Métis Council says a recent Supreme Court of Canada decision affirms Métis rights. The Grand Council Chief of the Anishinaabeg Nation thinks there was some overreaction at the Assembly of First Nations Annual General Meeting, and revitalizing and maintaining Anishinaabeg Bemowin or the Ojibwe language is the goal of one woman in northwestern Ontario who is organizing a language camp. And in Bomsida's musical spotlight this weekend, Jani Lazon. All these stories plus great tunes coming right up after your news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A handful of First Nations citizens have returned to their homes in northwestern Ontario. The Toronto Star reports about 150 people of the more than 3,000 are home after being evacuated because of forest fires. They've been evacuated from their homes since about June 21st. There are still just over 100 active fires in the province. Meanwhile, the Ottawa Aboriginal Coalition is also accepting donations for Kingfisher Lake First Nation evacuees. The organization is looking for basic food items, footwear, and other basic items for the nearly 300 people there. Evacuees from northwestern Ontario have been placed in more southern locations, including Ottawa, Wawa, Thunder Bay, and Dryden. Aboriginal People's Television Network has learned the federal government will soon cut off funding for specific claims negotiations. The network reports federal negotiators found out recently, but there has been nothing in writing. Negotiators who spoke with APTN wanted to remain anonymous. After the report from APTN, the Department of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development issued a press release. The Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, John Duncan, stated the recent media reports were not accurate. He says the government will continue to work with First Nations, but the government has recently adopted a new approach to speed up the process. A senior government official told the Canadian Press that any specific land claim that has been under active consideration for 3 years or longer will receive a final offer. Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, is among concerned First Nation leadership. Phillip says when the recent specific claims process was announced in 2007, it was a reason to celebrate. But since hearing the news on the changes to the process, Philip was surprised and frustrated.
We took the Government of Canada at their word. The National Chief was very much involved in the joint effort to bring forward the Specific Claims Tribunal Act, and we were hopeful that at long last we were going to be able to resolve the enormous backlog of specific claims. And now we're finding that Canada is simply using very unethical, shoddy, and disingenuous measures to create the illusion that specific claims are being dealt with in an expeditious manner, when in fact they're just being shuffled from one process to another.
Phillips adds he doesn't like Canada's take-it-or-leave-it approach when it comes to specific claims. Meanwhile, the federal government says it has successfully addressed over 445 specific claims overall. A couple of First Nations groups have pulled out of the Missing Women Inquiry in Vancouver, B.C. News 1130 reports the Union of B.C. Indian Chiefs and Carrier-Sicani Tribal Council have withdrawn from the inquiry because of lack of funding for legal representation. The funding for the inquiry doesn't allow for legal fees for any of the interest groups or witnesses. The province has announced it will only pay legal fees for people whose family members were victims of serial killer Robert Picton. That means no extra legal fees will be provided for sex trade workers, First Nations people, and downtown Eastside residents. The two organizations pulled out of the inquiry a few days after the Native Court Worker and Counseling Association of BC withdrew. Also, because of the lack of funding for legal fees, a key witness for the inquiry is not sure he'll show up. The First Nations University is back on track. The new president, Doyle Anderson, steps in his official role August 2nd. Plus, the books have been balanced for the first time in 7 years. There were fears the school was going to be shut down after financial irregularities were found. Since then, two school personnel in unrelated cases have been charged and convicted of fraud. The school was saved from being shut down by last-minute funding from the provincial and federal governments. A Supreme Court decision has affirmed Métis rights. The Supreme Court ruling came down July 21st. In the ruling, the court ensures Métis settlements in Alberta will continue to be protected. The case involved a family, the Cunninghams, who were removed as members of the Peavine Métis settlement because they registered as Indians under the Indian Act after Bill C-31 kicked in. But that's not something allowed in the Métis Settlement Act. The Cunninghams fought their removal from the settlement, citing as a violation of their charter rights. While the case was before the Alberta court, the court found there was no violation of the charter rights, and on appeal, the Alberta Court of Appeal ruled charter rights were violated. However, the Supreme Court overturned the decision of the Alberta Court of Appeal. The Supreme Court found that the exclusion of Indians from the Métis settlements is constitutionally sound. Métis National Council President Clement Chartier applauds that decision. He says the Supreme Court decision pretty much says an individual cannot be both.
In a sense, if I could use the crude term, I think the Supreme Court of Canada is saying, you know, you can't really, you know, double dip, take the best of the Métis world and the best of the Indian world, that you should, you know, make a choice.
Chartier adds the Métis Nation has to deal with the issue as First Nations deal with their citizenship, and perhaps one day both groups could consider dual citizenship. The deadline for people who attended Indian residential schools have just a little longer to apply for the Common Experience Payment. Application forms can be found on Service Canada's website or by calling 1-866-565-4526. The application deadline for CEP is September 19th. A study published in the Canadian Medical Journal reports that diabetes rates in the Aboriginal population in Alberta is slowing down. The increase in diabetes rates was less pronounced from 1995 to 2007. The journal also notes that diabetes rates were higher for status First Nation members than Métis or Inuit and is more prevalent in men than women. The mortality rates for status First Nation citizens were 1.5 to 2 times higher than that of the general population. Researchers for the study say more research is needed to understand the lower rates of diabetes in status members in Alberta compared with other provinces. More First Nations have signed on to the First Nations Market Housing Fund. The fund was established by the federal government and the Canada Housing Mortgage Corporation to give First Nation members greater access to housing loans on reserve and settlement lands. Deborah Taylor is the executive director of the First Nations Market Housing Fund. She says the fund helps gives more housing options for First Nations citizens on reserve.
I think that what the fund does is offers an option to First Nation governments and to their citizens for those who wish to either improve their housing conditions, for example, through renovation. So we have some people, for example, wanting to add garages to their homes or redo bathrooms, bedrooms, add an additional bedroom or redo their kitchen. It also has the opportunity to let people have their own homes on the reserve, so anywhere where it's communally held land, the idea being then that they have a financial stake in those homes, they have some control over those homes, the opportunity to pass them to another family member or to someone of their choosing. So it's giving an option both to people who live in the community now, who might be in rental housing owned by the band and who'd like something different. It's also giving an opportunity to people who want to move back home to have a different housing option. We don't seek to replace what's available now. We seek to complement.
The $300 million fund became operational 3 years ago. Aboriginal language revitalization and retention are constant endeavors around the country. In Ontario, a language camp for Anishinaabemowin, or Ojibwe, is being hosted near Pick River First Nation. Organizer Rhonda LeClaire says learning the language is a connection to Anishinaabeg identity.
It's our connection to who we are as Anishinaabe people. I know for me personally, it's my connection to who I am as an Anishinaabe Kwe. Like, that's where I feel who I am. I feel connected to being an Anishinaabe person through the language. It just feels right. It feels me. So I guess that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I want to keep feeling like that. It's our connection. It's our spirit. Our language tells us about who we are as Anishinaabe people, and we don't hear that enough. We don't, you know, so our youth are so, you know, disconnected to who they are as Anishinaabe people. We have to find those ways to help them find that connection, and the language is one way. I believe, is the way, our connection to who we are.
According to Statistics Canada, there are 50 different Indigenous languages belonging to 11 Indigenous language families in Canada. In the 2001 census, 21% of Aboriginal people could speak their language, and that's down from 26% in 1996. Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi says some chiefs were overreacting to Assembly of First Nations National Chiefs' call to eliminate the Indian Act and dismantle the Aboriginal Affairs Department. According to APTN, a couple of chiefs raised concerns that the AFN was ignoring the views of the treaty nations. Madabi says the issue has been discussed many times over since the National Chief was elected. Besides that, Madabi says elections for National Chief are really not that far away.
I think, you know, people have a tendency, you know, to get overexcited about something that is only a discussion item at this stage of the game. You also have to keep in mind that we're into the election year for National Chief, so, you know, political posturing will start to happen more and more as this year unfolds.
Madabi adds those issues probably won't hit the table in the very near future because First Nation leadership has been kept busy with immediate needs, including water, education, and healthcare cutbacks. The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs has a new Grand Chief. Derek Nepinak from Pine Creek First Nation now has the post. He takes over from Ron Evans from Norway House First Nation, who held position for two terms. According to the Winnipeg Free Press, new Grand Chief Derek Nepinak is the former chief of Pine Creek First Nation and co-chairman of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. Nepinak holds a law degree from the University of Saskatchewan and has studied Aboriginal governance at Osgoode Hall Law School. The election was held July 27th in a Pasquiat Cree Nation. There's a head shop in Winnipeg named Miigwech, the Anishinaabe word for thank you, and that has upset some First Nations citizens in the area. The sign on the head shop was actually pointed out by an 11-year-old girl to her father. Her father, Robert Sinclair, told CBC News that the language is sacred and doesn't want it to be a part of drug culture, and it sends the wrong message. He wants the owner to change the name, and the owner of the head shop didn't respond to CBC for an interview. The head shop sells cigarettes and drug paraphernalia. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Don't tell me I can't find the key when I'm halfway through the door. And when I want to stand, don't make me kneel down on the floor. Why do you try to hold me down while my heart's about to soar? Don't tell me it's all a waste of time. I said no, no, I don't wanna hear it, 'cause I know strength lies within my mind. First step fed and ginger do, with not much of a dance, but they'd still be sitting on the floor if they never took the chance. Johnny B. Goode sang rock and roll, Einstein MC squared. Failure goes to those who hide, success to those who dare. Don't tell me it's all a waste of time. I said no, no, I don't want to hear it, 'cause I know strength lies within my mind. Don't lie to me or put me down, please help me with this load. This aeroplane needs lots of room, so please don't block the road. Feed me love and inspiration, so you give me all you can. Don't turn away, I need you now, I'm holding out my hand. Don't tell me, don't tell me, don't tell me it's all a waste of time. Don't tell me, don't tell me, don't tell me it's all a waste of time. Don't tell me, don't tell me, don't tell me it's all a waste of time.
Kenny.
Yes, Dave.
I don't really understand what this song's about. I want you to tell me.
Well, okay, let me tell you what this song is about. It's about love, and it's about inspiration, and it's about how much we need that in our lives to feel good.
You know you're right. I need that to feel good, but I don't really know how to get it. Why don't you tell me? What do you do?
You don't know how to get that? Well, I'll tell you how to get that. First of all, you reach very too, David, because that's what this song is all about.
That was Don't Tell Me from multidisciplinary Métis artist Jenny Lazon, and that was cut from her debut album, Blue Voice and New Voice, which is mostly blues-inspired. Thanks to the new First Nations Market Housing Fund, citizens of 47 First Nations across the country now have more options when it comes to financing home on reserve or renovating current homes. Deborah Taylor is the executive director of the First Nations Market Housing Fund, and she'll tell us all about it.
The fund is the first national fund that was created to support arrangements between First Nations and lenders or financial institutions so that people who live on reserve can borrow for their own housing needs. So this could be for home ownership, for someone to either buy a house from another member or to build a new home on the reserve. It could also be to renovate an existing home, or it could be for the First Nation Council to provide some rental housing for their citizens or for people who come into the community to work there.
And how will this work?
Well, the way it works is that if a First Nation chooses to work with us, they make an application to us as a government. We look at them from three perspectives: their financial management, their governance, and their community commitment. And if they meet our criteria, then they can be backed for loans and capacity development, which is helping areas that we would help them do to strengthen their government. Sometimes a First Nation might only qualify for capacity development at the outset, and so we would work with them to strengthen to meet the criteria. But we are a non-profit trust company registered in the province of Ontario. We work with First Nations across Canada, and to date, 47 First Nations have chosen to work with us. We don't charge any fees, so it's really the time and trouble that the chief and council will take to make an application to us.
And how do you think the fund helps address housing demand on reserve?
I think that what the fund does is offers an option to First Nation governments and to their citizens for those who wish to either improve their housing conditions, for example, through renovation. So we have some people, for example, wanting to add garages to their homes or redo bathrooms, bedrooms, add an additional bedroom or redo their kitchen. It also has the opportunity to let people have their own homes on the reserve so where it's communally held land, the idea being then that they have financial stake in those homes, they have some control over those homes, the opportunity to pass them to another family member or to someone of their choosing. So it's giving an option both to people who live in a community now, who might be in rental housing owned by the band and who'd like something different. It's also giving an opportunity to people who want to move back home to have a different housing option. We don't seek to replace what's available now. We seek to complement what a community has and what they would like to do to meet their housing goals.
Just saying earlier that there's 47 First Nations on board with the fund, and how much more room is there for other First Nations to jump on?
Oh, we're certainly hoping that many more First Nations will choose to work with us. We're still a young company. We're just 3 years old, so it's taken time to establish that relationship of trust and for people to see the benefits that the fund can bring to them. But we did receive a one-time cash injection of $300 million from the federal government. We use that money as collateral security, so we use that to encourage financial institutions to lend to members on reserve. It has resulted in favorable terms and conditions for the citizens who are borrowing and also for the First Nations who are involved. So we have lots of room for many more First Nations to work with us.
That was Deborah Taylor, Executive Director of the First Nations Market Housing Fund. There has been controversy over this past week about the specific claims process in Canada. The federal government says it's doing what First Nations wanted in the first place, and that's to expedite land claims. But that was all news this week when anonymous negotiators told Aboriginal People's Television that the government was moving to cut off specific claims negotiations. After that story broke the news, Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Affairs Development came came back with a statement from Minister John Duncan. The department said, yes, some First Nations will be receiving final offers after 3 years of negotiations, but Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, says First Nation leadership was surprised by the recent move from governments.
The specific claims issue is a long outstanding issue with First Nations in this country, and in that regard, it has a pretty checkered history. To put that into context, when one looks back on the Oka conflict or the conflict at Ipperwash, and more recently Caledonia, all of those were triggered by unresolved specific claims. The Government of Canada has been hesitant and reluctant to deal honorably with these outstanding specific claims. Consequently, we have an enormous backlog throughout this country. The majority of those unresolved specific claims are in British Columbia.
So how many claims do you think have been addressed in BC? Because a statement from the Department of Aboriginal Affairs says there has been over 144 claims that have been addressed since 2007.
Well, this goes to the heart of the issue. The Government of Canada is really quite adept at deliberately misleading the general public on the resolution of specific claims. The fact of the matter is very few have been addressed, very few have been resolved. The processes available for specific claims resolution have been the subject of continual transitory change. The most recent was the new policy proclaimed in 2007, described as justice at last, and it brought forward the specific claims tribunal process. It took 3 years to operationalize that policy. It became effective, I believe, June 1st of this year. Now the Government of Canada, through the specific claims branch, has said October 16, 2011 as the deadline, and they're basically communicating to First Nations that you have to have your claims filed by that date. In the event that you do not have them successfully filed, that they will simply transfer them over into the specific claims tribunal adjudication process. What's really insidious and completely unethical about this is they're frustrating the filing and negotiation process by rejecting applications simply because a document might be somewhat blurry around the edges or those kinds of things. So the process has become very adversarial, very technical, very legalistic. Furthermore, they're sending letters to First Nations that indicate they're prepared to offer a partial acceptance and a very minimal amount of money in the context of the value of the claim. And if the First Nations were to accept that, which most will not, they demand that you sign a letter that waives the balance of the claim. And in the event that you do not take them up on that lowball offer, then they simply write back and say, well, we've made our best efforts. We're simply going to take this partial offer and roll it over to the tribunal process where it will be adjudicated. So as you can see, that incredibly unethical. It's sharp dealing and an incredible act of bad faith on the part of specific claims.
And so what is your organization prepared to do about this?
Well, at the moment, we're working with other like-minded organizations across the country and raising the awareness within the First Nations political community, so to speak, to make the leadership aware of really what the Government of Canada is doing. It should be noted the specific claims branch itself is subject to an evaluation, and they want to as quickly as possible transfer these claims out of the inventory of the specific claims branch into the specific claims tribunal, which will give them the opportunity to continue on with their propaganda to the effect that they've expeditiously dealt with hundreds more specific claims, when in fact all they're doing is shuffling them from one process to another. It's a very shoddy shell game, and is not what was the promise to, at long last, and i.e. justice at last, to fully acknowledge their legal obligations to First Nations and honorably resolve these outstanding specific claims.
So did you see any of this coming when the Justice at Last Action Plan was announced in 2007?
No, absolutely not. We took the Government of Canada at their word. The National Chief was very much involved in the joint effort to bring forward the Specific Claims Tribunal Act, and we were hopeful that at long last we were going to be able to resolve the enormous backlog of specific claims. And now we're finding that Canada is simply using very unethical, shoddy, and disingenuous measures to create the illusion that specific claims are being dealt with in an expeditious manner, when in fact they're just being shuffled from one process to another. Needless to say, specific claims represent an incredible potential for revenue streams to flow into our communities to underwrite the costs of social programs, wellness programs, economic and infrastructure needs, and we're being denied that opportunity by this insidious deceit on the part of the Government of Canada through the Specific Claims Branch.
That was Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs. Meanwhile, First Nation leadership are concerned because the tribunal is only authorized to pay out $250 million in settlements per year over the next 10 years, plus there's a cap on settlements at $150 million. Jani Lazon is in the music spotlight. Her album Thirst has a more jazzy feel to it than her blues-inspired album Blue Voice, New Voice. While most of the songs were penned by Jani, she also wrote some along with Arthur Renwick. Here's a song I would imagine was written all by Jani. It's Women Weep.
In the presence of love, in the presence of presence of in the presence of
The National Métis Council says a recent Supreme Court of Canada decision affirms Métis rights. Here's President Clément Chartier to tell you about the case.
It's a situation where land set aside by the province of Alberta in 1938 for Métis has experienced, as a lot of communities have, the imposition of the state in terms of defining who is or who is not Indian, and in a sense, who is or who is not Métis. The situation is that in the 1930s, when the land was set aside for the Métis in Alberta, it did not matter if one was a Métis or a non-status Indian, because both had the same social and economic issues. Now, the lands were set aside for the Métis, but my understanding is that non-status Indian who could not fit under the Indian Act also found their way into living on those land bases. And if that's not correct, at the very least, over the years, over the generations, many Métis men married Indian women. And, of course, their children are both Métis and Indian ancestry. And with Bill C-31 in 1985, many of the Indian women and their children who lost status under the Indian Act were able to either regain it, in the case of the children, to gain it. And, of course, many of these individuals were residing on the Métis settlements in Alberta. Now, the legislation also provided that the settlements are for Métis people, but there was also a provision in there that those who gained status prior to 1990, when the new legislation came into place, would be grandfathered in. Those that chose to opt for Indian status after 1990 would be no longer eligible to reside, you know, on the Métis lands. And that basically was the issue. Several people of both Métis and Indian ancestry chose to apply for Indian status and were successful, and the registrar moved to strike them, you know, from the registration lists of the settlement, and that precipitated a court action by those people that got struck off the enrollment list for eligibility to reside on the settlements. So that basically, you know, is the background to that.
And so the Supreme Court decision ruled that it was okay to do that, and it wasn't an imposition on their Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And why do you think that the Supreme Court decision is a good one?
Well, essentially, you know, for the First Nations people under the Indian Act, you know, there are land bases set aside known as reserves, and people who have Indian status are eligible, you know, to reside, you know, on their home reserves. In the case of the Métis in Alberta, the only lands available, well, actually, the only land base for the Métis happens to be those set aside by the province of Alberta in 1938. And again, it's for the Métis people, and you have Indian reserves for Indian people. So the Supreme Court of Canada basically said that those people of Indian ancestry who choose to be registered under the Indian Act, you know, have made a conscious choice, and, you know, their place of residence should be basically their home reserve, stating that lands were set aside for the Métis in Alberta, you know, for the purpose of preserving and enhancing Métis identity, culture, and self-government. And so it's not inconsistent with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Section 15, to have a program that's directed specifically at one Aboriginal people and not another. And so in this case, it says it didn't violate their rights because they chose to enroll as Indians and therefore, you know, have the benefits, you know, of Indians under the Indian Act, which would include, you know, residents on Indian Reserve. So they found that it wasn't, you know, discriminatory in that way. In the same way that when the Lovelace case, the casino case in Ontario took place, they said it wasn't inconsistent that the government would target the proceeds from the casinos specifically to the registered Indian community and exclude, you know, Métis and non-status Indians, because the program was meant to target and enhance benefits for a distinct group, if I can use that term, of Aboriginal people. So basically they found that there was no discrimination in that sense. And for the Métis, that's important because, you know, we've been fighting for generations to, you know, to gain some rights and some recognition. And it's good that, you know, we're able to be able to do that without having to do so, you know, being, I guess, having caveats placed upon us. Yeah, so I think in a sense that's good. Now, it's perhaps unfortunate for those people of both, you know, Métis ancestry and, say, pre-ancestry to have to make a choice, but there are choices to be made, and people make those choices. You know, I guess they do have to live with them. And in a sense, if I could use the crude term, I think the Supreme Court of Canada is saying, you know, you can't really, you know, double dip, take the best of the Métis world and the best of the Indian world, that you should, you know, make a choice. Ultimately, you know, we ourselves have to deal with this issue. The Métis Nation has to deal with its citizenship, as do First Nations. And at the end of the day, it's possible when we mature more as nations and people that we could be looking at the situation of, you know, dual citizenship. But we're we're not at that stage right now.
Hmm. So does the Supreme Court of Canada ruling affect or affirm Métis rights in any way?
Well, basically what it did is it built on the Pauli case. In Pauli, the Supreme Court of Canada stated that the Métis people's rights derived from the Métis ourselves after we emerged as a distinct people and before effective European control took place on our lands. They stated that Métis are rights-bearing people, full-fledged rights-bearing people, and that there are no hierarchy between Indian rights and Métis rights. And this case basically reaffirms again that position that, you know, the Métis are a distinct people and that the Métis have the right to basically determine for themselves, you know, who we are. And I think in that sense it's, a significant step beyond Pauli, if not at the very least a reaffirmation of their decision in Pauli.
That was Clement Chartier, president of the National Métis Council. Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi says some chiefs were overreacting to Assembly of First Nations National Chiefs' call to eliminate the Indian Act and dismantle the Aboriginal Affairs Department. A couple of chiefs came up with a resolution about that issue because they say they had concerns that the National Chief was ignoring the concerns of the Treaty Nations. Here's Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi with his thoughts on the issue.
Well, first of all, the National Chief has highlighted a discussion that's been going on for quite some time, and I think, people have a tendency, to get overexcited about something that is only a discussion item at this stage of the game. You also have to keep in mind that we're into the election year for National Chief, so, political posturing will start to happen more and more as this year unfolds. But the reality of the situation is that, we're going to wake up tomorrow and next week and next month and even next year, opening this discussion up more and more, that none of this is going to happen overnight. To try to undo, the legacy, the unfortunate legacy of the Indian Act is going to take a long time. And I think the National Chief... it's one of these situations, you can be criticized for doing something or would you rather be criticized for doing nothing? So I think he's at least opening the dialogue. I don't think, I'm not panicking right now that anything major is going to happen overnight. All he's doing is opening up the dialogue that's necessary to get the Indian Act off our backs.
And I also seem to remember that while he was campaigning, he was talking much on the same lines, and then after he was elected... he asked the chiefs throughout the country for proposals on solutions to the dismantling of Indian Affairs and the Indian Act. And considering that you're the Grand Council Chief of 42 or 39 member nations, have you seen any proposals of the sort since people have had about a year or more to prepare?
There hasn't been a lot of stuff come out. There have been so many issues on the table that, taking the necessary time to deal with the Indian Act, hasn't been a high priority. We're dealing with, major problems in water, major cutbacks in infrastructure and capital monies for our reserves, health issues and cutbacks to education have dominated the agenda. So, it's one of these situations where this is a necessary evil that we got to talk about, but it's just to try to find the time to do it. And, this is not a new issue. Almost every national chief that has come on the scene has raised a similar concern about the Indian Act, just as chiefs right across the country have raised concerns about the Indian Act. The national chief is at least trying to, open the dialogue, not only with the federal government, but more importantly, open the dialogue among First Nations. I think one of the things that has been interesting for me is that the National Chief has been very supportive of treaty implementation discussions and development of treaty commissions, and I don't think any treaty area should be worried, because at the end of the day, only the treaty signatories and the First Nations will ultimately decide what happens, not the National Executive or the National Chief. It still has to go, just like anything I do as the leader of my 39 communities, the Chiefs are the... decision makers. We help facilitate the discussion, and that's all the National Chief is doing, and I support his efforts.
All right, and just one last question is do you think that with the treaty areas that it can work without an Indian Act or Indian Affairs?
Oh, no question whatsoever.
You know, I go from my experiences of being a chief in my community. There's very little that Indian Affairs can do for our people. One thing about Anishinaabe people and First Nations right across the country is that we are resilient, creative, intelligent people that have managed to survive all these years. Not thanks to, but in spite of our government intervention in our lives.
That was Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi. And now for our third and final song from Bon Stadel Spotlight artist Jenny Lazon. And I'm going to play a song from her third album, Mixed Blessings. And she's truly a multidisciplinary artist. It's quite apparent in the musical genres she can reach across, from blues to jazz, to her album Mixed Blessings, which is more traditionally Indigenous inspired. But she mixes it up a little with some contemporary flavors and harmonies. Here's New Voice. Aboriginal language revitalization and retention are constant endeavors around the country. And in Ontario, a language camp for Anishinaabemowin or Ojibwe is being hosted near Pig River First Nation. Here's organizer Rhonda LeClaire.
The language camp that is scheduled to happen in our community, well, at Tuckasaw National Park, which is 5 minutes south of our community, Pig River First Nation will host the camp from August 16th to August 21st. It's a five-day camp, and it's located in the beautiful park of Tuckasaw. It has beautiful camping grounds and a nice outdoor facility with fire pit and wigwams, and it's a beautiful location.
And so why are you putting on this Anishinaabemowin language camp?
I just feel we have to create those opportunities for speakers to speak and for learners to learn. We can't just be learning in the classroom. I know I've been taking Ojibwe courses in the, you know, at university level, and I'm just not acquiring the language. So I recognize the need to create new speakers. The decline of speakers out there, you know, our elders are passing on, and that language is not being transferred. So it's just, there's this big need to create those opportunities, and the language camp is one way to do this.
And you said that some of the language speakers or the elders are on the decline, and so does that mean there are a lot or not enough language speakers out there?
Well, just based on what I'm trying to do with a camp, trying to find, you know, qualified native language teachers who want to teach in this kind of setting is kind of challenging right now.
You know, some people are not available, or, you know, I don't know what the issue is, but yeah, they're just trying to find, you know, teachers to come and teach at this camp. Right now I'm just looking at speakers to come so that we can be immersed in the language, you know, hear it consistently all day, and then hopefully that the learners will be able to pick up the language, because that's what immersion is all about, you know, being immersed in the language and picking up the language.
And so why is Anishinaabewan so important to learn, or why is it important to culture?
Well, it's our connection to who we are as Anishinaabe people. I know for me personally, it's my connection to who I am as Anishinaabe Kwe. Like, that's where I feel who I am. I feel connected to being an Anishinaabe person through the language. It just feels right. It feels me. So I guess that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I want to keep feeling like that. It's our connection. It's our spirit. Our language tells us about who we are as Anishinaabe people. And we don't hear that enough. We don't, you know, so our youth are so, you know, disconnected to who they are as Anishinaabe people. We have to find those ways to help them find that connection. And the language is one way. Yeah, I believe is the way. It's our connection to who we are.
Do you think there's enough interest out there to learn the language?
I think once the word gets out there, like, you know, I'm starting to get people, you know, across Ontario, you know, interested in this camp. And I know I've been going to camps for the last 4 years. And, yeah, I recognize that there are some people looking to find the language, to learn the language. And I think that through advertising, through, you know, marketing, you know, that people will, I think they need to know the state of the Anishinaabe language, what state, you know, that we're losing it, and that we need to, you know, pick it up again and use it and learn it. Like, even for our speakers, you know, I think it's a challenge for them too to speak the language. And as learners, we need to, okay, we recognize the need that our language is declining. We need to take that responsibility to learn our language too.
And so what needs to be done to promote the language more?
Well, I have this idea of doing a marketing campaign. You know, just thinking of Nike, you know, they have that big check mark, you know, just do it. I think we need to think along that same lines of a marketing of using the language. So when they see this symbol, I don't know what the symbol will be, but they will say, okay, they'll connect that with language revitalization. And if they know the language, they'll get that sense, okay, I need to speak it. And even with the kids, so I think, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to language revitalization. I just know that I just got to do something. Do something to save our language so that I can pass it on to my grandchildren.
That was Rhonda LeClaire, organizer of an Ojibwe language camp in Ontario. You've been listening to Bomb Sida with Jennifer Atwasige. Bomb Sida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Sida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bomb Sida.